Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with Dr. Holly Ordway. I've spoken with Holly on a past episode about her book, Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith, and her intellectual and emotional journey from atheism to faith in Jesus Christ. She has a doctorate in English literature from University of Massachusetts Amherst, an MA in English literature from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and an MA in Christian apologetics from Biola University. And now she speaks and writes regularly on literature, especially fantasy literature and poetry, and literary apologetics. In today's interview, I'll be asking Holly a bit more about literary apologetics and the Literary Apologetics Certificate Program. Well, thanks for joining me again, Holly.
I'm really delighted to be here again, Brian.
Well, last time we spoke, we explored your journey from atheism to Christianity and looked at your book, Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. So since then, I know you've been active in many ways doing apologetics and blogging and so on, but I'm curious what kind of response you've seen from your book now that it's been out a bit longer.
I've had a really positive response from people. It I think, has helped people see what the journey's like and see it experientially. And I think it's helped people understand that coming to the faith is not just a question of getting hammered with, you know, five incontrovertible proofs that Christianity's true. Okay, you're done. It's really an experience. It's a journey. And I've also found, to my delight, that it's the kind of book that people will buy for their skeptical friends, because it doesn't try to push these things on people. It says, well, here is my journey. And it's focused on truth, because I wouldn't be a Christian if I didn't think that Christianity is true, that is grounded in historical fact, that's objectively true. But I think the experiential quality of it and the holistic quality of the journey is something that has been striking a chord with a lot of people.
Well, the great thing is that it weds the personal with the rational, and it doesn't neglect either one. I want to know also if you could fill our listeners in on what's been keeping you busy now and what you may be working on presently.
Well, one of the things that came out of my work in talking about and doing interviews and discussions about Not God's Type was that it led me to reflect a bit more on my own journey. And I realized that I kind of backtracked and said, okay, the rational arguments convinced me. I became convinced through evidence that Christ rose from the dead, etc. And that's what sealed the deal for me. It was what gave me the information to say yes to Christ. But then I asked myself, well, how did I get those questions answered? Well, part of it was having a relationship with a mentor whom I could trust enough to ask these questions. And that's where the relational, personal aspect is so important. But then I started asking a question that I didn't explore fully in Not God's Type, which was, what got me to the point that I was even looking for a mentor or a friend to ask questions to? And that's where I started thinking through just really the power of literature, and realizing that I had almost not realized when I wrote my book originally just what an impact literature had. That poetry had been what opened the door, and the fantasy literature of Tolkien and Lewis had laid the groundwork little by little to awaken this interest, awaken this desire, expand my imaginative capacity, in a sense, and get me to the point where I actually wanted to ask questions. And that really led me into thinking, okay, this is a mode of apologetics that I don't think we're utilizing to the anywhere near the extent that we could today. And if it was what got me to the table to transform my life, you know, gosh, are there other people that we could reach this way? And so I've really been looking at the role of the imagination and literature in terms of apologetics. And that's my current project, and it looks like it's going to be my ongoing project for quite possibly the rest of my life.
Now, your heart these days really is for literary apologetics. So I want to ask first off, what is that? What does it look like? Pretend I know nothing about such a thing. How would you describe it?
I would describe literary apologetics as sort of a subset of what I think we might call imaginative apologetics, which is to say a mode of apologetics that engages the imagination as a mode of knowing. And there's been a few people doing some really excellent work on this in Britain, actually, but not a lot. And the idea here, it's something that C.S. Lewis brings up in one of his essays, that imagination is a mode by which we create meaning. It's the organ of meaning. And so if you ask yourself the question, how does a fact, it's like a propositional statement, become something that a person is willing to change their life for, that's where you get the question of meaning. So I would say that literary apologetics is the branch of apologetics in which we use the imagination to help draw people in through the experience of literature, or the arts more broadly, although I focus on literature, to have an imaginative and experiential grasp of the same truth that we're trying to present in other modes as well.
Holly, you've talked about what literary apologetics is, but can you tell me what it is not?
Absolutely. And there are two things that it's not. One of the things that it's not is writers saying, I've got an agenda, let me wrap it in a story so that it'll go down a little bit more sweetly. That's bad literature, and it doesn't help. It just doesn't work. So don't do it, because it's really not effective storytelling, and if it's not artistically sound, it's not going to have the effect that you're hoping for. So no, it's not just wrapping up a moral in a story and then saying, okay, that's literary apologetics. The other thing that it's not taking a work that has Christian truth and making it into just a vehicle for Christian truth, because the whole power of story and imagination is that it's more than the whole, it's more than the sum of its parts. So to take an example, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis really shows forth the truth about Christ and shows what it's like experientially, what does it mean that Christ is incarnate? But you can't just strip it away and say that that's what it's about. J.R. Tolkien has a great phrase. He said that's like you can't cut open a rubber ball to look for the bounce. So literary apologetics, to be the effective mode of apologetics that it can be, has to look at things holistically and appreciate the value of imaginative engagement as an integral part, not just an optional add-on.
Okay, very good. Now, you did mention how C.S. Lewis strongly influenced you and the writings of J.R. Tolkien. So I'm just wondering, maybe some people in their mind when they're saying, oh, literary apologetics, this is what you want to bring focus upon. Does that mean that we're just going to try to duplicate the sorts of things that Lewis or Tolkien did?
Absolutely not. And actually, that's precisely, I think, the problem in a sense, because we have some authors who've done literary apologetics in really powerful ways. Lewis is one, Tolkien's another, G.K. Chesterton is another. And if you look back, you've got all these poets who, like John Donne, George Herbert, who never set out to say, oh, I'm going to do apologetics, but actually wrote poetry expressing their Christian faith in such a way that it shows forth the truth. Now, the problem is that if you just look back a generation and say, oh, C.S. Lewis moved a lot of people, I want to, do work like him. If you're trying then to imitate, you're not getting what actually Lewis was doing, and you'll get kind of imitative junk, quite honestly. What we need are writers now who are looking at truth and using literature to express their encounter with truth, their encounter with the living God in new and fresh ways, not trying to imitate somebody else, but trying to call it like they see it. That's what we need today.
So is this a gift? Is this a skill, a call, or is it just thinking out of the box with the giftings that you currently have, or is it somehow all of the above or something totally different?
Kind of all of the above. And part of what's interesting about literary apologetics is that it's kind of two sides of a coin in terms of practicing it. And I'm actually in the interesting position of being on both sides of the coin at this point, which is, on the one hand, one role of a literary apologist would be to look at existing literature and say, how can we use this to show the truth of the Christian faith? So, for instance, you know, I lecture on John Donne, and I've done a talk in which I show the way that his poetry helps us understand the Trinity in a really experiential way. And you might have gifted teachers who could use literature that other people have written to really show forth Christian truth in apologetics. And then you have folks who might be engaged in the project of creatively writing this new kinds of materials. And there are people today who are doing this. So, for instance, one of the examples, just really, I think, excellent examples of this is Malcolm Guyot, who is doing an entire sonnet sequence going through the Christian year and expressing in contemporary language, in truth about Christianity and the experience of the faith. He's not imitating, you know, trying to copy somebody. He's doing new original work. It's astonishing. Now, those two sets of giftings are different, actually. Now, I kind of overlap because I teach literature, but I'm also a poet. So I'm trying to do and teach in both sides of this literary apologetics coin. But one thing I definitely want to say is that somebody who appreciates the value of literary apologetics might find that their gifting could fall into either of those categories or both and have a lot to contribute to those.
Yeah, you mentioned how this does flow over into different areas, and in my mind I'm thinking, does that, you know, mean songwriting, poetry, arts, film, dance, just the whole nine yards through these different outlets, just in vibrant, creative, inspired ways? Is that kind of how you would see it?
Yes, and I want to kind of qualify that a little bit. I do think literary apologetics is part of what I really hope is a new cultural renaissance for Christianity in the arts, because the visual arts and music and dance and sculpture have historically been ways in which artists have shown forth the truth of Christianity in ways that have convicted people and really gripped them. We need that. That said, I actually think that literature, the use of words, is particularly important because Christ is the Word made flesh. And I think there's a deep resonance to language with regard to the truth of Christianity that makes the use of language to show experientially the truth particularly effective.
All right. So you're kind of mentioning how some of these things have been done in the past, and earlier you just mentioned the work of Lewis and Chesterton and Tolkien and poets, and now you've mentioned sculpture and art, and we think of great music that was doing kind of what you're talking about. So where was this lost, and, you know, that we're trying to get back, if that's the right way to say it?
I think it is a great question, and I would say that we started losing it in the Enlightenment, because that's where we start to get a split philosophically between reason and imagination. And it doesn't hit right away, which is why we have great post-Enlightenment Christian literature. But if you read, for instance, the apologetics works of C.S. Lewis, he actually is pretty clear that this idea of this post-Enlightenment split of reason only as valued above all else is actually not the way the world works. And that's, I think, part of why his literature is so effective, because he isn't buying into this post-Enlightenment split. Because what we have, and it's gathered, I think, momentum in the last, I'm going to say, 50 years, this idea that there's a split between what we can quote-unquote know by reason, which would be things you can measure, facts, versus what we can quote-unquote know in other ways, and that would include imagination, emotion, etc. Now, the problem is that these two modes of knowing have been really entirely separated, so that we've got this materialism and scientism and this idea that unless you can measure it, it's not really true, and that goes in all sorts of terrible directions. But on the other hand, we also have the sense that if it's imaginative, it's not really true. It's just sort of fuzzy wuzzies or something. And that actually disconnects the work of the imagination from truth and renders it completely irresponsible. You know, turn the television, you kind of get the picture. And so that disconnect actually means that both the reason and the imagination are dysfunctional in today's culture. And we have to bring them back together. Because just having an imaginative vision is not enough. It has to be speaking truth. And just having reason is not enough if we can't take that reason and use it to create real meaning. And that's what literature does. It brings stories, poetry, all these things. If you can speak truth with imagination, you bring the two things together in a way that's just incredibly transformative.
That's good. When I think of great music or great art or great literature, excellence comes to mind. And I'm wondering if one of the things that has been lost is just the sense of excellence in our work for God or the things that we do as worship unto God. Would you mind talking a bit about your thoughts on that?
I think this is a case where good intentions are not enough, because there are a lot of well-intentioned people who think that just having an expression of faith is sufficient. Having a movie that expresses a Christian theme or having a book that presents biblical truth. The problem, though, is that if the work itself is not artistically excellent, then really you're falling short. God is ultimate truth. God is also ultimate beauty. And if we're trying to present the truth about Him in ways that are substandard, what is that implicitly saying about the God that we want people to come to know? And I think this is a case where we need to encourage Christian writers to set the bar higher and to really work at excellence and to show forth the truth in kind of out-of-the-box ways. Because speaking now, kind of going back and thinking about my experience as a former atheist, what I wanted to hear was truth. And a lot of truth is really discomforting. And if the only thing that Christian literature is presenting is the kind of easy, palatable truths about the world, that's not going to speak to the deep needs of people in a broken, wounded world. And so for me, one of the poets, for instance, who really helped me come to the Christian faith was Gerard Manley Hopkins, who writes a series of sonnets called The Terrible Sonnets that are really bleak. They're about depression and struggling with doubt. And those sonnets are just absolutely excellent in terms of quality, and they're brutally honest in terms of emotion. And that helped show me that if Christianity was true, it really did encompass all of life, the whole experience. It didn't leave anything out. And so I think that as Christian artists seek to really do this apologetics work, they have to be both pushing forward into telling the whole truth, even if that truth is discomforting, and also doing it with a really high standard of beauty, so that someone who's not a believer would be drawn to the work by its beauty, by the power of its story. And that's where the work can really happen.
You know, the thing that strikes me about what you're saying is that if we're to create something of excellence, that we have to be people of excellence, that, you know, you can't separate doing the work of an expert if you're not an expert, or, wow, that work's really professional. You have to be the professional. You have to be the expert. You have to be an artist. You have to be a poet, but you have to be an excellent poet, the kind that the world would look at and say, wow, that's a poet. And so the challenge, I suppose, that comes to mind is not just how can we generate these things that are great, but how can we be the kind of people that create those things? Does that make sense?
It does. And actually, that's, in a way, part of what I'm doing with the Athanatos Christian Ministries, which is to try to provide a structure for people to learn how to be that person. Because writing is a discipline and a skill. And I think, just broadly speaking in culture, I teach writing, it's what I do for a living. So there's a real misconception that people are just natural writers. I think it's true that some people have more of a gift for it. I definitely think that's true. But a natural gift is the same thing as having a natural gift for running. You don't get people running the Olympics with just natural gift. They train. They train consistently. They practice. They get the best coaches. They take care of themselves. And so the same thing with writing. If you're going to be a writer, you have to, and you really want to do this to the glory of God and service of the kingdom, as opposed to just, you know, for fun. If you really want to serve, you have to be disciplined and you have to work at it. And so as a writer myself, there's great joy in what I do, but it's often really hard. And it just takes work. And that sense of joyful discipline is one that I think it's really valuable to impress upon people, that this is like writing, doing literary apologetics, is like any other endeavor that you might do. Fortunately, you don't have to rely just on natural talent. I mean, if you've got natural talent, that's great. But it can be taught. You can learn how to be better at whatever it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're partnering with Athanatos Christian Ministries to do some projects that help promote and equip others in literary apologetics. So can you talk a bit more about the program that you've put together and explore it a bit?
Yeah, I've been actually working with ACM for a couple of years, speaking at their online conferences and really finding that we are on the same page in terms of this vision for doing apologetics and changing culture through the arts and through writing. And so I jumped at the chance to become the director of the new Literary Apologetics Certificate Program. And so this is a program which I guess the best way to think of it is a combination of a writer's workshop and lifelong learning for people who really want to do apologetics and who want to be making a difference in a practical sense. So it has two components. There's an apologetics component of learning, like what are the things that I want to share? You know, really getting the answers to these tough questions. And then the other part of it is the literary part of it, where we're looking at, okay, let's look at the great literature of the past that has accomplished what we want to do. Let's look at Lewis, Tolkien, Chesterton, etc., as recent examples. Let's look back further at other great artists. We're setting the bar pretty high. We're going to look at Shakespeare, John Donne, etc. See the ways in which they are presenting truth through literature, and seeing the ways in which it's often presented subtly and indirectly, as opposed to here's my moral, you know, go forth and, I don't know, absorb it. It's really being presented in a holistic way through the stories and through the poems. And then we're going to have a practical component where people are actually bringing their own writing to the workshops and working through how can I do this? How can I improve this?
What's involved in the actual certificate program itself? What's the workload? And you've mentioned some of the things you'll be covering, but maybe someone who's listening right now is thinking, wow, you actually have something that I can explore and perfect my craft. What are they going to get into if they sign up for this program?
Well, first I want to mention two key facts. One is that it's a completely online program. It's 100% online. And so it's really ideal for people who are in full-time ministry, who are working full-time, who have families, because it's really accessible. And I appreciate the value of this because my apologetics degree is from Biola, and that is a modular program. So I've actually been through a completely online program in apologetics and saw really how valuable that was to be able to study while I was still working full-time. So this program's online, and the sequence overall, the whole certificate is 16 courses, 8 in the general apologetics and theology, 8 in the literature writing component. That's the complete certificate. You can also take individual courses as standalones. And so someone who maybe is thinking, well, this sounds exciting, but I'm not quite sure if I'm ready to make commitment to a 16-course program, I would say, by all means, we've designed it so that you can step into it with a course here, a course there, and then decide if you want to move on and take the whole certificate.
So is this like they can start anytime they want, do bits and pieces here according to their own schedule, or are there certain set times where you'll be running the program? How does that work?
The courses run in chunks. I guess it's not a very technical word, but so for instance, the two courses that I'm teaching this spring, start February 20th. There's one that's a five-week course called Principles of Literary Apologetics, and there's one that's a four-week course called Wordsmithing. And so for each of these courses, within the given week, we have reading assignments, audio lectures, some video clips from online, and discussion boards that are asynchronous. So, you know, you could be on at 2 a.m. and somebody else could be on at 5 p.m. and you'll, you know, read the posts as they're posted and respond as you see them. So you're working in a sense at your own pace during the week, but then we would expect that you would be tracking with the class so that you would finish, you know, each week's work, move on to the next week to, you know, build on that. And then at the end of the course, you've finished it in a specific slated time. Then, of course, you have the decision to make, well, how many courses do I want to take at a time, and do I follow up right away with another one? So the pacing of the for the certificate, that can be spread out over a shorter period of time or a longer period of time. The individual courses are designed that you've got a mix of being able to self-pace, but while also having the structure of following along with a class with a definite start date and a definite end date.
Well, very good. Holly, I wonder what would be, in your mind, the perfect picture of how people would take this torch, if you will, of literary apologetics and run with it to carry this out?
I would like to see two things happen, and they're complementary to each other. One of them is I would like to see people who are currently interested in apologetics take up literature as a complementary mode to what they're doing, to say we have the reasoned arguments, but let's also use literature in this exploratory, experiential way to help reach the people who won't be reached any other way, and to use the great writers and to use the great poetry and drama to open the door, and also to help people grow once they're, you know, taking a few steps along the way. So I think there's a huge, huge place for literature to be used in tandem with kind of traditional apologetics. The other torch I'd like to see picked up is with the writers of today saying, great, you know, we have the great apologists who were writers like, you know, Lewis, and we have great works like Lord of the Rings and things like that. Okay, well, who's going to be writing the 21st century works of great literature that won't be copies, but they'll be speaking to they'll speak into now and speaking forth truth in new ways. Same truth, new ways. So I want to see writers picking up that torch and saying, I want to be able to show forth the light of Christ in my writing. Now, that doesn't have to be with books that are explicitly Christian, because you can present truth, Christian truth, without actually ever saying, you know, anything specifically about God. I mean, the Lord of the Rings does not have anything specifically Christian mentioned in it. George MacDonald's novel Fantasties, which was tremendously influential for C.S. Lewis, does not mention anything specifically about, you know, church or Jesus or anything. Totally Christian works. So I would really like to see new authors really committing themselves to excellent work, expressing their worldview in that writing.
Well, if people want to find out more about your ministry and the Literary Apologetics Certificate, where would you want to direct them online?
I would say one-stop shop, send them to my blog, to Hieropraxis, which you can also get if you go to hollyordway.com, easier to spell. And on my blog, there's my own ministry, my own writing and speaking ministry, and there's also a link there to the Athanatos Literary Apologetics Program, and, you know, right in my navigation bar, so people can get more information directly there and then contact me with any questions they might have.
Holly, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the work that you're doing.
I've been speaking with Holly Ordway, professor of composition and literature at MiraCosta College in North County, San Diego, and author of Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. Links to Holly's book, her website, and other resources can be found at today's blog post at Apologetics 315. If you found this interview helpful, please share it with a friend via email, Facebook, or Twitter. Just taking a moment to do this really does help to spread the word about good apologetics resources, and you never know how it may help someone struggling with doubt or simply wanting to be a better defender of the faith. Be sure to check out other podcasts as well, found in iTunes by searching for Apologetics 315, and there are a number of them, including ones on logical fallacies, how to get apologetics in your church, the read-along podcast, and this podcast as well. If you are a regular listener or a visitor to Apologetics 315, please continue to pray for this ministry as it grows. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, feel free to email interviews@apologetics315.com. This is Brian Alton of Apologetics 315, and thanks for listening.